Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gab Fest, the Pardon Me edition for March 29th, 2018. I'm Emily Bazelon. John and David are, I don't know where they are, off on vacation, but who needs them anyway? Because I'm here with two excellent guests, Jamel Bowie, who is the chief political correspondent for Slate. Hey, Jamel.
Hello.
Hello. And Jack Hitt, who is a co-host of Uncivil, Gimlet's amazing podcast about the hidden history of the Civil War, which you should all go and download as soon as you finish listening to this show. Hey, Jack, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Emily. Hey, Jamel.
Okay. On this week's show, we are going to talk about three topics. The Trump administration has a plan to add a question about citizenship to the 2020 census. A bunch of states and civil rights groups are suing over this idea. Why is this a very big deal? Our second topic, the legal plot surrounding Donald Trump thickens. I think maybe we could have that as like a tagline every week. But this week in particular, the New York Times is reporting that Trump's erstwhile lawyer, John Dowd, dangled the possibility of a presidential pardon in front of former campaign manager Paul Manafort and national security advisor for a nanosecond, Michael Flynn, before they were indicted and, in Flynn's case, pled guilty. So Dowd isn't actually Trump's lawyer anymore. Trump is looking for new lawyers, so we can talk about how much we think that we should care about that. And then finally, there is another whole legal subplot going on involving Stormy Daniels, her accusations that Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen, paid her hush money, her efforts to get out of her non-disclosure agreement, and the entry into the story of her lawyer, Michael Avenatti, who is a kind of enjoyable character in this drama, which is packed with too many characters. Okay. And then our third topic is the partisan gerrymandering case that was before the Supreme Court this week. This one is from Maryland. It's the second partisan gerrymandering case that the court has heard this term. Why is this issue back in front of the court? And what did we learn from oral argument this week? And of course, we'll have cocktail chatter. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross announced this plan to add a question about citizenship to the census. Ross said he was responding to a request from the Justice Department that the citizenship data would be would help the Justice Department better enforce the Voting Rights Act. We can discuss that rationale in a minute. There are a dozen states and civil rights groups who are suing, and they are saying correctly that the Constitution says that the census has to count all persons. And their argument is that by adding a question about citizenship, the Census Bureau would interfere with this mandate to count everybody because the count is going to go down. And the states in particular are claiming harm because this, if there's a diminished count, then that will affect their ability to be able to get government benefits for their citizens. Jamel, Marco Rubio is saying that this is like a big freak out by liberals. Like, what's the big deal? Asking about citizenship, it's just going to be the last question on the form. On your alarm scale, how high does this register?
I think this is a pretty serious thing. Having an inaccurate count of the people in the country is a recipe for misallocating all sorts of resources. And when the people who are going to be undercounted are disproportionately Hispanic, African-American, low-income, this has a whole other level of distortionary effect because the other thing that census is used for is reapportionment of congressional representation. And adding a citizenship question makes it far more likely that we're going to get an undercount of those aforementioned groups, which will end up in reapportionment, shifting power away from urban centers, away from predominantly non-white communities. It's kind of a big deal. It's kind of a problem. The idea that this is just like a liberal freakout, that this is overblown, is in fact belied by the fact that past Census Bureau chiefs, people who are intimately familiar with the census, have also been sounding the alarm and saying, no, we really shouldn't have a citizenship question on the census.
Right. I mean, that was actually a bipartisan response by former census directors. Right. And they talked about, they called it highly risky to introduce this kind of question so late in the process. Is part of this, Jack, just like a problem of making this change at the last minute?
Well, that's one of the arguments that the experts are saying. But the effect that this could have beyond what Jamel was just saying about reapportionment and so on, one estimate is that like California might lose an entire congressional seat. Texas would gain 7 seats in the state House of Representatives. So there would be a huge shift in power and allow minority white districts to retain power in minority majority places. The other thing is that, you know, they've tested this a couple of times in other kinds of census experiments. And I was reading about one where, now understand, Latino counts by estimates have go down every census because of this panic. So it went down 0.8%.
Panic over ICE, being identified by the government and being detained or deported.
Accidentally outing one of your relatives. So there's a lot of people who are legitimately could be counted as citizens who are terrified to answer the question, right? So we're now putting this question on the census. And the question is, are you a citizen of the United States? It's that simple. And so they've done these tests. And the accounts are amazing. Like, you know, at one point in the middle of the census questioning, the woman just ran out of the house. In another case, when they came back, the family had moved away. So, it's clear that it's going to cause panic, and it will definitely drive down numbers that are already going down by a big amount. The other thing to say here is that, like, this idea comes from people like Kris Kobach and other really radical sort of alt-right, peppy meme-loving Republicans. It's been promoted by the guy who was briefly nominated to be the head of the census by Trump, was a guy who literally wrote a book arguing against competitive elections. He actually thinks like having no competition, just straight up handing the seat to Republicans is the way to go. So there's a lot at stake here.
So the census did a study and they showed that there's already, as you were saying, a groundswell of concern about data sharing and confidentiality, citing, you know, fears of ICE and what's happening with the Dreamers right now, particularly among Spanish speaking and Arabic speaking residents of the United States. That makes me wonder if one argument here is like already people are scared and nervous. And so like, so what? So adding that question, like we've implicitly made people think so much more about citizenship as a mark of residency or belonging is actually adding the question really its own harm. Or to ask this question in a different way, has the Trump administration effectively already won? Because even if this gets tied up in court and the citizenship question doesn't go on the census, there's all this news and fear and alarm about it that is already going to depress the count. Jamel, what do you think about that problem?
You know, I think that's a fair observation. The effect is already there. There will be most likely a greater undercount of these communities for the 2020 census. I'm not sure how one prevents that. That it's actually interesting. I have this is extremely anecdotal, but
go for it.
I have some college classmates who are either formerly undocumented and no longer undocumented, or are engaged in a lot of that activism. And on their Facebook pages, they're like very vocally saying, "No, we have to be counted for the census." So my hunch, just based on that anecdotal evidence, is that efforts to convince these communities to participate are already ongoing. But no, Emily, I think you're right that the damage has sort of already been done, that the Trump administration has been so successful at instilling fear in these communities that when the census comes around, a lot of people are just going to not want to participate.
In the U.S. Code, it says personal information cannot be used against respondents to the census by any government agency or court. But if you're inclined to be worried about this, you might note that during World War II, the Census Bureau gave the names and addresses of Japanese Americans to the Secret Service, and that was part of the information used to round people up and put them into detention camps. So, you know, one of the other rationales the Trump administration gave is, well, we asked a question about citizenship between 1820 and 1950 on the census. What's the big deal bringing it back? Currently, we ask on the American Community Survey, which goes to 1 in 6 households, we ask about citizenship there. So I guess, again, I'm just asking, like, is this as big a deal, as big a difference as people say? What's the argument to kind of push back against that history?
Well, during Obama's, you know, handling of this, right, in 2010, this issue came up. And again, you know, the Republicans tried to underfund, the census then. His ICE his immigration cohort rigorously pursued their jobs throughout the census, and Obama literally said, like, don't let that worry you. You know, they went ahead with the count. So on some level, maybe, I mean, we don't know just how big a freakout it's going to be. But we did go through this in 2010, and ICE was in full force, and people did get counted. Maybe not to the, you know, according to sampling, maybe not to the levels that they should have been.
Almost, right. I mean, one of the things that struck me about Ross's letter was that it was very carefully written, right? So here's this rationale that, like, we need citizenship voting age population data in order to enforce the Voting Rights Act. If you were, you know, going to take that argument in good faith, you would say, like, it's true that there's litigation around Latino representation in states like Texas. And one of the questions is, how do you make sure that you're not diluting the power of the minority vote? You look at citizenship voting data in order to make sure you have enough people who actually can vote as opposed to just people who are Latino but can't vote. And yet it's just so hard to take a Trump administration concern about the Voting Rights Act at face value.
That is the greatest argument from the Trump administration since they fired James Comey on the grounds that he was unfair to Hillary.
Exactly.
Right? I
mean, exactly. We have these arguments that, like, seem so reasonable. And yet, you know, though, it struck me reading this letter that the Trump administration has come a long way from the travel ban. And what I mean by that is, like, that rollout was so ham-fisted. It was such a mess, such an obvious problem. Now when we see government agencies doing things that seem to have fairly sinister connotations, they do it much more skillfully. So I'm also thinking of the news this week that Scott Pruitt, the head of the EPA, said, you know what, we're only going to look at studies where the data is transparent. We care a lot about transparency. So what does this mean? It means that studies that have been crucial to looking at pollution and chemical exposure often use confidential health data that can't be made public because it's, like, people's confidential health data. And so you have this seemingly very benevolent rationale about transparency being turned to this other use. Jamel, do you feel like that, you know, the folks who are running these federal agencies are figuring out how to do their jobs? They're just getting more competent?
No, I think that's right. I think we're more than a year into the Trump administration at this point, and it's just simply the case that the political appointees, especially the sympathetic bureaucrats who may have entered with President Trump's administration, have just gotten more savvy and skilled at what they're doing, grown more effective at subverting the missions of their institutions, if that's their goal. It's certainly true at the Department of the Interior. It's true at the Department of Justice. The thing I always think about is, this is the stuff that's going to take a generation to reverse.
Yes, I totally have been thinking about that because, you know, the 2020 census, those numbers stay with us until 2030. That's right. A long time. Even absent the citizenship question, we have a census with budget cuts, with no permanent director. And so there's also just, like, this erosion and denigration of government going on.
There's another sort of diabolical feature to this particular question and its long-term impact, besides sort of lowering congressional seats on the Democratic side and raising them on the Republican side. There's another level in which you can kind of gerrymander districts using the Voting Rights Act. So you can create a Republican majority district by vote and a Democratic majority district by numbers. So if you put in, say you have a 52 to 48% Democratic majority district, but if you make 7% of them non-voting non-citizens, then you actually have what looks like a Democratic majority district, but in fact, it's a Republican majority. So it's another tool in the sort of gerrymandering quiver.
Totally. And this is related to this principle of one person, one vote and how we interpret it. And the Supreme Court settled this question very recently. There's this case called Evanwell versus Abbott, brought, by the way, by Edward Bloom, the same guy who is very good at challenging affirmative action in various universities around the country. And this was this open question somehow that had never been settled. Does one person, one vote actually mean, like, one human being? Or does it mean someone who's eligible to vote or likely to vote? And the Supreme Court said one human being, but one of the reasons was that the census didn't count citizens. And so the data wasn't as reliable, the data we have from the American Community Survey. And so another sort of like lingering question here is whether there's, you know, in line with the Chris Kobach agenda of requiring proof of citizenship at voting, you could also go back and open up that precedent about one person, one vote and change how we count people.
I really see all of this as part of a, you know, the United States is becoming more racially diverse. This growing cohort of non-white Americans are more liberal voting. Even if they identify as conservatives, they have less conservative views on a variety of issues. And really the only hope for the kind of traditional hardline conservative agenda is sort of making sure that white Americans, and in particular white Americans in rural and ex-urban places, maintain kind of a grip on political power. And all of this, to me, you know, from not just gerrymandering of congressional districts, but this attempt to kind of gerrymander the census, to the occasional every couple years, a Republican lawmaker somewhere float this idea of allocating electoral votes on the basis of congressional districts. There seems to me to be like an actual effort to attempt to gerrymander American democracy writ large to ensure a kind of like extended dominance of a cohort of white Americans in national politics.
Yeah, it really struck me, this particular statistic I found, that in the 2020 census, for the first time, people are predicting that the white share of the population is going to fall below 60%. And maybe it's anxiety over that shift that's driving a lot of this. So I'm glad you brought that up, Jamel.
I mean, I think, you know, Democrats are in a very tough place trying to argue that counting citizens is a bad idea. It just doesn't sound good on television. But also, just watching Pelosi and some of the others react to this, it's amazing how incompetent the Democrats are at trying to frame a counter issue.
So what did she do that you thought was lame?
Well, so she said, you know, like, this is going to hurt vulnerable communities.
Right. Other people's vulnerable communities.
Exactly. She said, you know, Trump is putting politics over the Constitution. That's precisely what they want to hear. Right. He's stirring things up, you know. And the other thing she said was like, you know, he's not listening to the experts. Are there 3 points that could not possibly fail better than those three?
So right? what if you were Pelosi's message crafter, what would you recommend?
Well, a couple of things. One is there was this really radical right police chief in Los Angeles named Daryl Gates from years ago. Remember him?
Yeah, totally.
So he actually had this special order that he made to all the cops, which is that under no circumstances were they to inquire about someone's immigration status. The reason being is that it would cause a spike in crime. That if you drove people away from cooperating with law enforcement institutions and other things like that, that basically it would make his job harder. And so there's a whole crime, a law and order argument in favor of making an accurate count of the people and not just citizens, right?
Yeah.
You could get cops to step up to that. There are also a huge number of Republicans who oppose this change. Because they're from states where their districts are going to be disadvantaged after the count.
Right. Alabama might lose a whole congressional
seat. Right. New Jersey is the Republicans there are vehemently against this. So, I mean, there are Republicans that you could put forward so that it looks like an unfair change in the census.
Right.
And change the complexion of the way the whole debate happens rather than playing in specifically to the Trump voters' worst desires.
All right. Okay. We can we'll offer that advice up for Nancy Pelosi. I'm sure she's listening.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Before we get to our second topic, I just want to tease our Slate Plus topic today. Jack and Jamel are going to come up with some excellent food and cooking advice for me and for you too, Slate Plus. All kinds of things that I don't have time to figure out myself, they are going to figure it out for us. And I also wanted to remind our listeners that the GabFest has a live show coming up on May 2nd at 7:30 p.m. in St. Louis. Special guest Jason Kander at the Sheldon Concert Hall. So go to slate.com/live for tickets. We hope to see you there.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming only on Hulu.
Our second topic. So we have this news story this week about John Dowd, Trump's erstwhile lawyer, offering to pardon Manafort and Flynn. It struck me reading this news, which I should say that Dowd denied, that it seems at once totally bizarre and not normal. And yet also I could imagine Trump like going on TV the next day and being like, yeah, we did that. So what? And in fact, I found a tweet from July in which Trump said, all agree the U.S. president has the complete power to pardon. So, Jack, what do you think the political consequences of the story about this dangle of a pardon offer are going to be? Will there be any, I suppose?
Well, I think the thing to watch for is whether Dowd lawyers up in the next couple of weeks.
Because
one argument, right? One argument is that he quit because he was afraid that Mueller was coming after him. I mean, the thing to remember here is that Trump can say all this stuff because he's the president of the United States. He can probably get out of this. But these other people, they're living in our world where the law still matters, right? And you can't just buffalo your way through these arguments. And Dowd may be one of those people. To me, though, I'm not clear. The rumor is maybe he quit because of this pardon thing. Or
that he was forced out.
Or he was forced out. Stories. I mean, yeah, it's not clear why exactly he quit. But it is clear that he's left Trump with essentially a bunch of radio talk show hosts and thuggish blowhards like Michael Cohen to be his legal representation.
Yeah. Jamel, do you have any thoughts about the Dowd story? Do you think should we care whether Trump has like a really top high quality lawyer in his corner?
So I don't know if we should care, but it is interesting, right, that the president of the United States cannot get good legal representation. That someone who,
true,
you know, one would assume that at least some top shelf firm would want to represent the president, but it turns out none of them do. The three of us on this call could get better legal representation right now than the president of the United States. And that I find just remarkable.
Speak for yourself. Nobody would ever want to represent me. I'd be a terrible client. No, that's not true. I'm very dutiful at such moments. Go ahead.
I just find that remarkable.
Right. Well, there's some calculation. So obviously whoever does this is going to be super famous and gets lots of attention. And yet you have a client who doesn't listen to you. I mean, that seems clear, right? I mean, another possible reason for Dowd leaving was that he was telling Trump not to sit for an interview with Mueller. And Trump is insisting, like, I'm going to do a great job with that, despite his reputation for, let's say, inaccurate statements and bloviation. So there's that problem. And then there's also the idea that Trump could turn on you on any second and you could become the goat in the story, right?
I've heard two theories about this. One is that in a lot of the prominent law firms, there are a number of women now who are at partner level and they're putting the kibosh on this. Yeah.
Interesting.
The other one is that it possibly may be that at least in legal circles, we've reached this tipping point of Trump's dignity wraithing, as Josh Marshall calls it, where like people fear that if they take this job, rather than amplify their resume, it's actually going to ruin them. What it did to Gary Cohn. I mean, there's a number of people now who are just wandering the earth, you know, sort of like shells of their former selves. And it's now
Rex Tillerson.
Right, Tillerson. I mean, and people see these guys and they realize like, in all likelihood, that will be me if I take this job.
So should we be worried in either sort of criminal or constitutional terms about Trump's lawyer dangling this pardon offer? Let's assume this story is true. So there is this interesting piece on the blog Just Security this week by Alex Whiting, who's a Harvard law professor. And he was making the argument that a pardon dangle is different and actually more problematic, legally speaking, than an actual open pardon offer. And so Whiting's argument is that Dowd dangling an offer before an indictment and guilty plea was done in secret, done to discourage cooperation with an ongoing investigation without any kind of public scrutiny. So you're sort of saying, like, I promise, don't worry, trying to early on cut off whatever cooperation Flynn is giving and Manafort could give, and that we should actually analyze that differently, legally speaking, in terms of its constitutionality and the possibility that it could become part of an obstruction charge against Dowd or against Trump if Dowd could then say that Trump encouraged him to do this.
I hate to say it, but everything I've heard from legal scholars kind of concurs or agrees with Trump.
That the pardon
power is pretty absolute and there's no good constitutional law behind any kind of restriction of it. And so, you know, I don't know, giving it or dangling it, I think...
doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. At least it's not clear.
Jamel, what are your thoughts? Any?
I don't have any particular expertise here, although I think my intuition is also that the president's pardon power is absolute. But this just gets to sort of the way in which Trump and the people around him, right, by being essentially shameless, have completely confounded the constitutional order. on some level, this right. whole system only works if the people within it have some sort of shame, which is a signal of some sort of commitments beyond themselves, or even a commitment to their own mm-hmm. sort yep. of like self-interest in not just an extremely narrow venal sense. But because Trump doesn't have that, the system is sort of like at a loss for what to do with him. Intuitively, we all kind of think that dangling a pardon in the face of an investigation is wrong. Like, even if it's not like illegal, he shouldn't. You would imagine that a different president with some awareness of what this might do to his party, of what this might do to his agenda, would refrain from taking that step. But because Trump only really thinks about himself in his sort of animalistic, my immediate security sense, those considerations aren't there.
Right. I mean, I have to point out, as I always do, or David does at this point in the conversation, that if we had a Congress that was willing to think hard about what it means to have a president corruptly use his power, that, you know, impeachment is not narrowly defined legally. But because the Republicans in Congress have so little interest in this, we end up having a conversation about what's strictly unlawful in either criminal or constitutional terms. And right. you're right. We totally don't know the answer to that. They're unsettled questions. Instead of having the more sort of like reasonable or easier to attain conversation about norms and what's right or wrong, we end up with this conversation about like legality and the precise meaning of corruptly impeding an investigation in the obstruction of justice federal statute.
You get this sense that in certain circles, there are these norms and people in those circles are abide by them and are alarmed when they're breached. And then there's the president.
One more thing that I found really just striking about this story was that it leaked. I mean, and maybe this is the lawyer in me, but there's all kinds of attorney-client privilege that should be relevant here. The lawyers for Manafort and Flynn, who didn't comment in the Times, they shouldn't be the sources for this. Dowd shouldn't be the source. Like, where did this come from? Did it come from Trump or Manafort or Flynn? What other staff members know about this idea? I was really confounded by that question this time.
Where would it have come from? I guess, I mean, is there an advantage for Manafort or Flynn's counsel to leak this? Does it maybe encourage Trump to pardon them? Or, I mean, is that a strategy?
Or someone who's out to get John Dowd? I mean, yeah, obviously the story is the worst for mm-hmm. Dowd. He's the only one who's directly on the hook. Yeah, right. The whole thing, like that part of it sort of bothered me.
I mean, were there other people in the counsel's office that were vying for Dowd's job?
Well, it doesn't seem that way. No, because the White House counsel is like over there separately, right?
McGahn.
Don McGahn,
yeah,
right? And even Ty Cobb was organizing how much to cooperate with Mueller and what to turn over, right? All right, we have to talk just a little bit about Stormy Daniels. Her lawyer, Michael Avenatti, I am really enjoying his entry into the drama. He's like just such a particular character and type. So he's being super aggressive. He's having a great time with his moment in the sun. He this week filed a motion. He wants to depose Trump to take his sworn testimony. He also wants to take the testimony of Michael Cohen, Trump's lawyer. And this is all, of course, about this $130,000 payment made to Daniels days before the 2016 election. Jamel, some commentators seem to feel like Stormy Daniels, this is a sideshow and it has a kind of like Monica Lewinsky possible feeling to it of, you know, far, far from the Russia investigation, all about the president's sexual peccadilloes, like it's sort of beneath us. Is that how you feel about it? Or do you think there's something more substantive to think about here?
See, I don't think it's beneath us to pay attention to this. There's at least one actually quite serious concern that this raises, which is that if the president and his team have been willing to spend large sums of money to cover up an affair, what else has Donald Trump in his past spent large amounts of money to cover up? How blackmailable is the president? But beyond that, I mean, just thinking politically, I think it's significant, not just that the president is kind of caught in this scandal. Like, unlike everything else, I mean, really, unlike almost every other scandal, this one has had real staying power. That's in part because of the Daniels legal team has done a great job of keeping the story in the news, of releasing tidbits, of dripping out information, and kind of taking advantage of the media's sort of obsession with
appetite. Appetite. I couldn't resist handing you that, giving you that word. Maybe it's not the one you want, but it seemed so fitting.
Yes, yes, no, exactly. As this is ongoing, we learn things like that this NDA may not actually prevent Daniels from speaking. If there are other women for whom Trump has done this, that also raises a question about their NDAs and their ability to speak publicly. And I do think this has a real potential of snowballing and also does affect the political situation of the Republican Party, which is then forced into kind of at least addressing this, if not defending the president's actions.
Yeah, that's really interesting. The slow drip, the idea that Stormy Daniels is using a strategy that Trump himself is so masterful at and kind of teasing little bits of information. It's all, of course, reality television.
That's how I understand Stormy. Is not as a legal question, but as a competitor in the Twitter sphere and in the attention markets. Today, it's about campaign finance reform, or maybe it's about defamation. That's the new angle.
Or you know, threats against her.
Threats against her
while
in a parking
lot. She's, like, taking her daughter out of her car seat.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, she's dropping one crumb at a time, and she's doing to Trump what Trump is doing to the country. This Twitter, constant Twitter feed, constant turning the story back to her. Understand, the 60 Minute show got better ratings than every episode of The Apprentice. He knows that, and it has to be galling, right?
Right.
And so, if you don't follow Stormy on Twitter, you really should. She is brilliant at fending off trolls. She corrects their spelling when they come at her with vulgarity about her about what she does for a living. She's super sex positive and just comes right back at them. Vulgarity doesn't shame doesn't affect her. Because she is coming to this in this wide open way, right?
In the same way
that Trump was, Teflon candidate back when Jeb and Marco and all these guys were trying to hurl insults at him. She is doing to Trump what he did to us.
Yeah, as someone who's written about sex work, to me it is so gratifying to see a porn actress and a businesswoman come forward and be kind of frank and forthright and, to me, credible. And just as you're saying, like, unembarrassed. Mm-hmm. I feel like she's doing a really good job of representing herself. And she reminds me a lot of characters in The Deuce, David Simon's show,
yeah.
Right?
Yes,
about
yeah.
the porn
yeah.
industry and mm-hmm. Times Square in the 70s. Like, there's just a kind of openness to her, the way she's presenting herself, that I think is just, like, really good.
Well, one last thing we'll that see. She's done that sort of taking a page from Trump's own playbook is that apparently, he does now have a nickname, just like he gives other people nicknames.
Oh, really?
President Spanky.
Oh, very interesting.
Apparently, even Republicans down in D.C. are using it.
I didn't know that. And I should have, because I've been waiting for the nickname. I feel like that's actually been a problem for people opposing
right.
Trump, that he has been so much better at nicknames.
That's true. I thought Benedict Donald would catch on, but I think President Spanky has, better
yeah,
legs.
Yeah, I feel like that's more catchy. All right, we're going to have to wait and see where that goes too.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
Third topic, the lawsuit Benisek versus Limon came to the Supreme Court this week. This is a lawsuit over the 6th District in Maryland, which was redrawn in 2011 to boost the likelihood that the party would go from having 6 Democrats and 2 Republicans in Congress to 7 Democrats and 1 Republican. And when he was asked about this redistricting plan in a deposition, the Democratic former governor of Maryland, Martin O'Malley, said, "Yes, I did my duty within the meets and bounds of Maryland law to try to help my party." He knew that this redistricting would be more likely to elect a Democrat than a Republican, and that was clearly his intent. So that O'Malley is on the record saying that, just like Republican lawmakers in North Carolina have been on the record saying, like, yes, we did political gerrymandering. We thought it was perfectly legal. So sue us. And in fact, that
is
what—
And it is perfectly legal.
And it has been perfectly legal. Exactly. So, Jack, should it continue to be perfectly legal?
Well, so that's the question that maybe the Supreme Court is going to take up. But, you know, he has another line in there where he says, yeah, I created this district so it would be more likely to elect a Democrat than a Republican. Yes, this was clearly my intent.
Right. So we're make no mistake about it.
He is saying what the Supreme Court said, which is, you know, districting is purely a political act, a political phenomenon, and should be, you know, entirely handed off to the legislatures, right? He's also, by the way, in favor of reforming how we gerrymander. But he's out of the closet saying, yes, I do it, and which puts him a little bit ahead of some of the other governors pretending like they're making a fair, you know, map. By the way, just to give you a sense of just how gerrymandered some of our states are, I just looked up, like, so Pennsylvania, which normally is a battleground state in the presidential elections, meaning it's roughly 50-50, is 13 Republicans out of 18 seats. North Carolina is the same. It's 10 out of 13 seats a Republican in a battleground state. So, I mean, it has huge effect, this case. But the question is, what can the Supreme Court do to change the partisan gerrymandering that goes on? Because it seems like 50 years ago, maybe it was harder to gerrymander because there just wasn't good data. But the problem is now is that you can really fine tune the data so that you can actually move one house after another with these great computer programs, and you can actually gerrymander every district to a fare-thee-well. I mean, you can actually get precisely the exact vote. It's no longer the voters selecting the representatives. It's the representatives selecting their own voters.
Right. And the answer to your question, what can the Supreme Court do, is the judges can use those same tools to analyze how much partisanship went into the gerrymandering, mm-hmm. how much this redistricting is based on party preference as opposed to the traditional principles that some states put into law about, you know, how compact is the district? Does it respect existing county and city lines? Are the districts drawn in a manner that's contiguous?
But is that something that the Supreme Court can even solve? I mean, can you decide how much partisanship goes into a gerrymandering?
Well, that was like the, I would say, one of very few interesting moments in oral argument this week was this question. So we have a long tradition of addressing racial gerrymandering, right? But as I think Chief Justice Roberts pointed out, we don't say, like, okay, a certain amount of racial discrimination in drawing districts
right.
is okay. But with political gerrymandering, the courts are likely to say that as long as the districting in many states remains in the hands of the legislatures. And so I think the hope, if you want the courts to step in here, is that they're going to start by saying, well, really extreme efforts at gerrymandering are unconstitutional. And then you have sort of two questions. One is this question of intent, which O'Malley was so nice to put on the record. But presumably, if the courts start treating this in a more suspect fashion, future politicians are not going to say stuff like O'Malley said. And then you just have, like, the various measures of partisan asymmetry that different political scientists have come up with to look at. And I mean, to me, it seems like you could wrestle through that. There could be a whole bunch of lower court rulings and efforts to figure out which of these tests are more useful, or you put together some composite of the tests. And that all seems like within the realm of the courts if they choose to do it. Jamel, what do you think about this from a kind of political as well as legal point of view? Because, you know, one of the arguments against worrying too much about partisan gerrymandering is, well, you know what, Democrats and Republicans have sorted themselves anyway into cities and rural districts. And yes, Republicans have a geographic advantage, but that's not something that courts should worry about. That's something that, you know, the political system should address on its own or not address.
It strikes me as an argument that just doesn't take history into account. The best example of this is if you go to, like, the Midwest, right? And you get a map, population map, population by partisanship, And you looked at it and you're like, oh, look, all the Democrats concentrated in Cleveland and they're concentrated in Cincinnati and they're in Chicago and Milwaukee and so on and so forth. Sure, you could say this just reflects kind of the natural geographic distribution of partisan identities. But if you overlay that map over a map of population by race, what you'd see is that all those Democratic concentrations are largely just Black people. The reasons why there are a bunch of Black people concentrated in a bunch of into particular census tracts in particular cities has everything to do with discrimination and racial violence and so on and so forth. For me, at least, that raises a really important question, which is, like, do we want our system for districting to basically reinforce racial inequality? I understand that's probably not something that the court is terribly concerned with, but as politics, as something to discuss in, like, public life, I say that no, that we don't want that and that we should be looking for ways to make sure that it doesn't. The narrowness of conversations over gerrymandering, I think, frustrates me because what we're dealing with are broad questions about the kind of democracy we want to have. For my part, it is not great that if you happen to live in a city, if you happen to live in a segregated neighborhood, your vote essentially begins to mean very little in the scheme of things.
Can I just say that, you know, there is another solution, or at least one kicking around, which is that voters themselves, even ones in districts that they like, are repelled by the idea that they don't get a choice. I got to give a shout out to Republican Governor Larry Hogan of Maryland, who actually filed an amicus brief against himself and his state in favor of a nonpartisan commission being created to draw the maps. And so that's one thing that's happening in some of the states is that the voters are demanding that the redistricting be taken away from the legislature and given to a nonpartisan committee. And I don't know if that solves the problem, but one thing it will do is it will make those sort of like unsightly, the salamander portion of the gerrymandering metaphor less likely. So if you look at like Pennsylvania, a lot of these districts there around, say, Pittsburgh are these big rural swaths taking a small bite out of Pittsburgh to dilute its urban power. It looks ridiculous if you just look at the current map. And if you look at the map that the court drew, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. The maps that they drew, it's largely just like this clump here and this clump there. It looks right. The other one doesn't look right. And there's a visual component to this that I think would be harder to pull off if you had a bipartisan committee saying, like, come on, Bob, look at this, what you've drawn here. You know, it's ridiculous. Right?
Yeah. I mean, the nonpartisan commissions in some states like California have been successful when measured in terms of how many competitive races there are, which is a pretty good way of thinking about this. And then you can also think about, you know, fairness, sort of edging toward proportional representation. You know, so one argument against the Supreme Court finding a way for courts to address partisan gerrymandering is like, well, states should all have nonpartisan commissions. And if the courts can't remedy this problem, that will push more states in that direction. I don't know how that strikes you, Jamel.
I'm actually fine with that. If you would have asked me this 5 years ago or 8 years ago, my inclination would have been to say that, yeah, this is a fundamentally political enterprise and that it should remain a political enterprise. But as the technology has grown more sophisticated, I think that in itself is a very important change that, for me, means that maybe we should take this out of the hands of politicians, or at least take this out of the hands of partisan entities and put it into the hands of, I think, a still accountable institution, something that's still accountable to voters, but something that isn't directly concerned with partisan concerns. One thing I'd also want to add to this conversation is there seems to be inadequate representation in general. There are 320+ million people in the country, but we have 435 representatives in the House. And I think that sort of ratio makes these conversations over gerrymandering and over redistricting even more fraught. There's just this limited pool of potential representation. There are a variety of schemes that would say increase its size by, you know, 50 seats or 60 seats or 70 seats, and those would be largely distributed pretty evenly across the country.
That's really interesting. Yeah, and that's a nonpartisan, obviously, or could be.
Right. I mean, yeah, it's the kind of situation where California would get, like, you know, 13 additional seats, but Texas would get 9, and Georgia would get 3, and it would all kind of balance, they'd all balance each other out. taken nationally.
I have one more observation I want to make about the Supreme Court. So one of the questions, why did the court take this Maryland case since it already had a gerrymandering case from Wisconsin? And when the court took the case, my assumption was like, well, if they're going to find that there's no way for courts to do anything here, you don't need a second case. So it seemed like maybe the idea was to have a case where a Democratic gerrymander was being challenged, and that would provide some political cover for addressing this problem. But I had another thought about this after oral argument. So the key vote on the court is Justice Kennedy on this case, presumably. Justice Breyer, who seems in favor of finding some kind of role for courts in policing partisan gerrymandering, he floated a couple times in argument the idea of, let's kick this to the calendar for next year. Let's hear Wisconsin and Maryland and the North Carolina case and think about all of them together and what kinds of remedies we could have that would address the different kinds of gerrymandering, the different kinds of proof we have in these cases. And first I was like rolling my eyes at this idea. I mean, really? Like, we need to do this all over again? And then I thought, huh, if they have to do it over again, that would be reason for Justice Kennedy to stay on the Supreme Court next year. There have been rumors, as there have been for the last few years, that he is about to retire in June. This is a big deal issue, one that he has written about in the past and seems to care about a lot. And I wonder if Justice Breyer has a sort of alternative motivation here.
Wow, that's some serious triple bank shot there. That's really nice.
I have zero evidence for this. I just like wanted to throw it out there as a possibility.
Gabfest conspiracy theories.
Exactly. All right.
The thing about you mentioned Kennedy, as I understand it, his argument is that an excessively partisan gerrymandering, disfavors different people's First Amendment rights, right?
Yes.
To express your political opinion.
Association.
If, right.
Yes, exactly.
And so if you marginalize a whole group based on their political association, you violated their First Amendment rights.
Yes.
Which is a really cool way to think about it.
Yes. And that is actually the main argument of the challengers in the Maryland case. So that was another possible reason why they added this case to the docket. You're absolutely right.
Do you ever feel like there's nothing new in the news? You know there are urgent things happening in the world around you, but all you hear is noise. That's why we made What Next. Our goal is to tell you the stories you haven't heard before, or maybe a different side to the story you thought you already knew all about. I'm Mary Harris, the host of What Next, and I love my job because it helps me cut through the noise of the news. And then I get to bring it to you. Together, we can figure out what next.
Jamel, when you are further recovering from your cold over the weekend and ready to drink, I don't know what, maybe bourbon? Bourbon seems like a good thing to drink when you're recovering from a cold. What will you be chattering about?
It's bad for your, alcohol is bad for your throat when you're recovering from a cold. What will I be chattering about? So I have recently been on this Michael Mann kick, director Michael Mann. Mm. And so I've just been watching a bunch of Michael Mann films. And the one film I wanted to recommend is 2004's Collateral, which I feel like is like an expensive movie that has two big stars, Jamie Foxx and Tom Cruise, but is basically like banished from the cultural radar. It is this, I'd say, strange, like anti-action movie. You can imagine the pitch. We want you to make, you know, a thriller involving one of the biggest stars in Hollywood. But what it turns out to be is this like very cerebral, very tense film for the first hour and a half that in its conclusion becomes a kind of like Michael Mann does his take on a Jason Voorhees movie with Tom Cruise playing the monster at the end. It's very strange and very interesting. I would highly recommend it. I also recommend Mann's follow-up to Collateral, which was his 2006 Miami Vice film. It's this extremely strange kind of like deconstructed action film where the action is sort of incidental to the entire narrative and everything's about atmosphere and feel and mood. And it also stars Jamie Foxx and then Colin Farrell is the white guy in this case. Highly recommend them if you're looking for just sort of quasi-experimental mainstream movies to check out, which is what I do when I'm sick.
Jack, what are you going to be chattering about over a drink this weekend?
Well, what I have been chattering about is this writer, television producer, Anthony Horowitz. I read a book by him By the way, let me just back up and say, like, you know, occasionally I will run into something that I really like. Like, for instance, when I saw Mark Rylance in Cromwell, I had read Hilary Mantel's books and loved that show. And then I found myself just basically renting every Mark Rylance movie. So lately, that's just how I've been doing stuff. So I read Magpie Murders, which is this sounds like a really dopey book because it's a book about a book editor editing a mystery novel. And then the novelist in the book gets killed. It sounds super hokey. No, it sounds super hokey.
I read it too. It's really enjoyable.
It's really good. Yeah. And I thought he really outsmarted me where I was expecting the narrative to go and where I thought, like, maybe this is going to be a little too clunky when he marries the fictional world with the nonfictional world. And he really pulls it off. It was really entertaining all the way to the end. And then I found myself a while back slipping into a British television series called Foyle's War, which if you haven't seen, is fantastic. It's about a detective trying to, you know, hold law and order together during the middle of a World War II and right afterwards. Turns out every one of those episodes was written by Anthony Horowitz. And then I just picked up, my wife and I are Sherlock Holmes freaks, and we're reading together right now a book called Moriarty. Turns out that's also written by Anthony Horowitz. And I really just kind of like, oh, wait a minute, is that the same guy?
All paths lead to Anthony Horowitz. Yeah. It's not like five people.
So this is an accidental sort of Mark Rylance thing where I'm suddenly like up to my nose in Anthony Horowitz. But I will say that, you know, for this kind of middle brow kind of mystery plotting, he is better than average. I mean, much better. Like with the Sherlock Holmes book, there's certain expectations you have when you're reading a Sherlock Holmes book. Like if Sherlock Holmes is not in the story, then he's in disguise somewhere in the story, right? And he's already messed with me on that one. Throughout the book, he knows what your sort of narrative expectations are and is fooling with those while you're reading or watching the show. So anyway, recommend him.
Cool. All right. Well, those were both much more fun chatters than mine. I'm going to play my usual legal nerd role. I am really interested in a petition before the Supreme Court by Brendan Dassey. So Brendan Dassey, you may remember, is the teenager in the documentary Making a Murderer. And if you saw that documentary or just catch this bit online, his interrogation is this completely terrifying moment in which he's this kid who doesn't totally understand what's going on, and the police lead him to implicate himself in this like murder. And it seems apparent that he's falsely confessing, and yet he was convicted in part based on this videotaped deposition. So his petition to the Supreme Court would rectify that injustice. I mean, to me, watching this videotape, it just seems so apparent that some travesty has occurred that I can't believe the lower courts didn't figure out a way to overturn the conviction, but they didn't. And more broadly, his lawyers, or at least like the various friend of the court briefs, are arguing that what the Supreme Court should really be doing is setting a standard for how juveniles can be interrogated, one that recognizes the same science about adolescent brain development that has led Supreme Court justices, in particular Justice Kennedy, to worry about death sentences and life without parole sentences for juveniles. So I'll be really interested to see if the Supreme Court takes this case. And also in lawsuit watching land, Maryland and D.C. got through the very first round of the emoluments clause suit against Trump. So this is the suit that says that because Trump owns a stake in, you know, various businesses, in particular the Trump Hotel and the U.S. Postal Office building, I think that's right, that Maryland and D.C. have had businesses that have been harmed by this competition, and that because the president isn't supposed to be able to accept gifts and emoluments, that this should be illegal. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of depositions and evidence gathering discovery the judge allows in that case. So far, it's alive and well.
Can somebody create one of those charts where we have all the sort of zones of lawsuits that are going after the president? Because you've got emoluments, you've got Stormy is now doing this sort of, you know, defamation thing. But that was also, defamation was also Jessica Drake, as I recall.
Yeah, and Summers.
Or no, Summers, Reservos.
Yes, Summer.
Drake was harassment.
Right.
Right. And then you've got Schneiderman, the AG in New York, going after some of these real estate things. And then you've got, you know, Mueller, of course, going after whatever, money laundering, collusion, something, obstruction. It just seems like pretty much every zone of
the presidency
of legal pursuit somehow has a lawsuit tied to Donald Trump.
And for all of this, we can thank, of course, Paula Jones, who, when she sued Bill Clinton, the Supreme Court said, no, it is not too distracting to force the president to be the target of a civil lawsuit while he's in office.
And you saw that Stormy is now insisting on a deposition.
Yes.
The best reality show
ever. All right, that's our show for this week. Our researcher is Izzy Rode. Our producer is Jocelyn Frank. Steve Lichtai is executive producer of Slate Podcasts. Our show page is slate.com/gabfest, where you'll find lots of links to things we talked about this week. Our Facebook page, facebook.com/gabfest. And check at Slate Gabfest, our Twitter feed, for updates on all kinds of fun things. Our email address is gabfest@slate.com. And you can search for Slate Political Gabfest in the Apple Podcast Store. And leave a comment and rating while you're there. If you're a podcast listener, you know how important that is. For Jamel Bowie and Jack Hitt, I'm Emily Bazelon. Talk to you next week.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C., on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets. I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.